This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
If you are wondering how long this high-consumption civilization can keep going on, you are not alone. It's not just counterculture types either. A small parade of billionaires have appeared on the financial blog Zero Hedge, predicting a shattering financial crash. But seldom do we find academics asking, is global collapse imminent? That is the title of a new research paper which adds an updated comparison of the limits to growth with historical data. The author and our guest is Dr. Graham M. Turner. He is a principal research fellow at the Melbourne Sustainable Society Institute, which is part of the University of Melbourne in Australia. Now, the original Limits to Growth study in the 1970s helped shape the entire environmental movement. It was remorselessly trashed by pro-business writers, and they said proven wrong and consigned to the dustbin of history. Now, many of us sense we are teetering on the edge, so I'm really pleased to have this opportunity to talk with Dr. Turner. Graham, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you.
Oh, we should probably step back a bit and explain what the original study was, the who and the how it was done. Can you fill us in?
Sure, yes. And this takes us back, four decades, back into the early 70s. And a group of researchers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology were sponsored by the Club of Rome, who were a group of entrepreneurs concerned about the environmental future of the Earth. And so they had these scientists at MIT make a state-of-the-art, at that time, computer model of the world economy and its environment, and all the way that the various systems, agriculture and industry and so on, interact. And then they populated this model with the data that they could find, and then ran scenarios going from 1970 forward to the end of this century. And most of those scenarios turned out rather bleakly, I suppose you could say, in that they led to growth and then an overshoot and a subsequent collapse in the economy and in the population. And depending on the scenario that came to pass because of different reasons, resource constraints or pollution and so on. But they did also find that they could engineer in the settings of some scenarios a stabilized world, one that was essentially sustainable. So the work they then published became pretty much infamous and, as you said in the introduction, really got shot down through some mistruths by economists and others who thought that growth could go on forever.
Well, it does appear to the untrained eye that the limits to growth never materialized as predicted. After all, the world economy grew enormously. Standards of living have gone up in many parts of the world. We even accommodated a few billion more people since the 1970s. So what inspired you to do this checkup?
Indeed. Yeah, well, I was doing research on the Australian economy, its sustainability, and we were, when we published our results, this is going back a number of years now, we were sort of tarred with the same brush, oh, that's limits to growth, and they were wrong, weren't they? And so I was curious, I knew of the limits to growth and Club of Rome, but I thought I'd better take a closer look at this, and found that when I read the book, actually, they weren't wrong. They did actually in their model have a growth happening in the economy well up to the year 2000 and further. So what the critics had said was blatantly wrong. And then having read the book and looked at the scenarios, it occurred to me that we had a rather unique chance to compare what has actually happened in the 30 and then 40, now 40 years since they ran their models out into the future. We could compare real-world data with their various scenarios. So that's what I've done most recently.
Well, let's talk through a couple of case studies comparing what was predicted in the limits to growth to what has actually happened. And why don't we start with their economic predictions versus what is happening right now?
Sure. So if you take, I suppose these days we would call it their business as usual scenario. That wasn't their label, but...
Can I just stop you there, Graham? What do we mean by business as usual? We use that pretty casually. What does it really mean?
Well, it means that we keep doing things basically the way that we've been accustomed to. We keep being more productive and getting higher and higher efficiencies. It means we might continue our increasing trends in consumerism, buying more and more material goods and so on, that sort of thing. Basically, our economy operating as usual.
Why don't we return then to, I'm sorry I interrupted, but it just struck me that we don't really always define our terms very well. So what did they say would happen with the economy and what is happening in your view?
Sure. So in the business as usual scenario, they saw that population did indeed keep increasing, you know, through the 6 to now 7 billion level. They saw that industrial output continue to grow and that sector producing goods for the population meant that then everyone was getting wealthier in their model on average. This is a global average. And that industrial sector also produced more things, I suppose, like fertilizers and machinery and so on, to be able to grow more food, so food per capita also increased, as did services, which they saw as providing, say, education and health. But then a couple of other things also happened in concert with that. Pollution started to increase, but that was coming off a very, very low base. So in their model, you know, up to about this point, pollution doesn't have a dramatic effect on the economy or the environment. And then sort of the other sort of major piece of the model was that resources, non-renewable resources, were continued to be used by the industrial sector. And so they were dropping down from their initial very high abundant level. So that takes us to about this point in our history.
Well, but it seems to me, reading this paper, you've almost returned to the peak oil scenario, saying the ever-increasing diversion of capital into more difficult-to-extract fossil fuels like the tar sands or deep oil drilling. You know, you say that's, quote, the primary cause of the collapse of the business-as-usual scenario. Could you explain that?
Yeah, that's right. And there's data lining up with all of this, you know, development. As we've seen, we know from the real world data that population and industrial output per capita and so forth has increased actually the way that scenario pans out. And it occurred to me that since in the business as usual scenario, the key mechanism was about resources getting harder to get. Not disappearing altogether. They never disappear altogether, never actually get exhausted, but that they get harder to get. And that sounded to me a lot like the peak oil issue. And so I've looked further into that, and you know, we know that basically our production rate of conventional or the easy oil appears to have peaked in recent years, and you know, you can still debate the actual year, but there's much greater consensus that easy oil production rate has peaked, and therefore we're now moving into the more difficult to get the resources, the deep water supply, the shale oil, shale gas. And the key here, although there it's a really vast resource, we shouldn't confuse a stock with a flow or a tank with a pipe, because the issue is how difficult it is to get those resources out of the ground. And that appears to be the case with some of these shale oil and shale gas and so forth. They take a lot of capital, a lot of energy. And so you draw that away from the rest of the economy. In fact, you take it away from the industrial sector itself. You know, there are more tankers and pumps and so forth being used in the resource sector. And that means that the industrial sector can't replace its degrading capital as well. It doesn't keep up with its aging, and consequently, its output actually starts to fall. And that's the key mechanism in the limits to growth business as usual scenario that leads to collapse. And it, in some regards, that appears to be playing out right now.
Well, you know, I could almost compare that to the model, a personal level, you know, that if we have to pay more and more for gasoline just to get to work, there comes a point where we can't afford to go shopping for anything else. And that impacts the economy. And that may be happening on a giant scale with the investment that's going into energy ever increasing to a point where there's not much left to do anything else. Is that what you're saying?
That's right, and that's a good analogy at the household level, that you're having to spend more on being able to commute into work, but the irony is you then can't buy more things in order to support the economy. And indeed, I'm suggesting in the paper I've published that we could look closer at the issue of peak oil as a potential trigger for the global financial crisis. Because energy prices, oil prices, and hence food and other things were going up as peak oil started to hit back a few years now, then that meant that households which were on the edge of being able to pay their debt, their mortgage, were no longer able to do that. They just couldn't afford it. And hence there was this coordinated default, which was perhaps one of the triggers for the GFC. And there may well be others, but these things often work in interrelated ways.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. Our guest, the well-known researcher from the Melbourne Sustainable Society Institute, is Dr. Graham Turner. His paper released in August 2014 asks, is global collapse imminent? Now, Graham, despite the fears about peak oil, there is no shortage at the moment. In fact, oil prices have just gone down below $100 a barrel. And I've talked with an energy analyst for the U.S. Energy Information Agency, who has released a report predicting that consumption of oil and gas will go up from current consumption around 88 million barrels a day to 115 million barrels a day in 2040, despite rising prices. To me, that's incredible that we could still be predicting an oil economy that far into the future, given what we know about what we've just been talking about and about climate change, all those sorts of things. What do you think of that forecast?
Well, I think, you know, these things are still contentious. I know that there is other research that points a rather critical finger at, will we still be able to produce more and more oil and gas out of these difficult resources? They suggest that actually some of these large figures about how much oil we could produce might produce in the future may be talking up the industry more than anything. So, you know, we have evidence that some of these wells actually dry up rather quickly in the space of a matter of years, or start their decline actually starts in a matter of years. And so you have to drill more and more, leading to exactly the sort of thing I was just talking about, the capital needed for that. But I guess, Alex, just the other point that I think you also raise is that, okay, if that rather optimistic in one sense proposal or proposition that we might have lots of oil and be producing, consuming more in the future does come to pass, then that translates the issue into the other realm of climate change. And indeed, that would take us more into a sort of slightly different scenario in the limits to growth. So it's a bit like trying to stop a balloon bursting. You know, you squeeze it in one direction and then it expands out in another. Well, this is just the same. If we keep using those oil and gas and coal, we will make the climate change issue even worse through the greenhouse effect. And, you know, we're already seeing an increasing spate of weather-related disasters, and this might just be the tip of the iceberg.
Well, your paper uses the word imminent, and so let's say we're looking at 2015. What might some of the signs be that a global collapse is developing?
Good question. Difficult one, I think. I think some of the signs are the lack of reinvestment in the industrial system. So are we maintaining our roads and rail systems? What about our electricity distribution networks and so on? And anecdotally, there is the sense that some of that maintenance is sort of perhaps falling behind. So that might be, you know, sort of one trigger to look at. Another could be, are we finding it more and more difficult to increase the level of food per capita? Is that starting to saturate?
Do you picture global collapse as something that's slow and steady over a decade or two, or is it comprised of a series of sudden vertical shocks? What do you think?
Alex, that really gets into a much harder domain. It's sort of this butterfly wing effect where the trajectory could go very many different ways depending on what might seem like a small event somewhere in the world could trigger, you know, wars or the opposite. Perhaps a global leader will appear on the scene, although that seems highly unlikely. Yeah, and the limits to growth model and the scenarios in there, as they play out, they show a fairly rapid decline in things. So population starts to fall at about 500 million per decade from about 2020, 2030 in the business as usual scenario. Industrial output per capita actually falls much faster and earlier. So it's one of the sort of canaries in the cage. But whether that actually plays out in reality is, as I said, rather, it's really sort of speculation. Very difficult to tell.
It is. Now, your report worries about the astronomical levels of debt piling up around the world, and you go on to say this debt could have a negative impact on our environment. That intrigued me. How would that work?
Well, I guess the issue is that even if there was a large realization that we've perhaps pushed the environment and resource use a bit too far, perhaps even if we had the intention, the motivation to try and get on a sustainable path, now we've built up these high levels of debt, which aren't still really paid off around the world. And so it becomes very difficult to see how we could finance the changes we've made, because we would need to make massive changes sort of through our industrial system into getting into renewable resources and so forth. Although one of the things out of my research, which is sort of not directly in the limits to growth modelling, is what comes out of this other research is that perhaps an easy sort of strategy would be if we could coordinate through government control a decrease in the working week so that over time, over many decades, people actually worked shorter and shorter weeks. Of course, that is going to play into incomes, which then would mean that we wouldn't be able to consume as many material things. But at the same time, we should be able to have better lives by spending time with our family and friends and so forth. And this sort of mechanism would ease the pressure on the economy, and it would ease the pressure on the environment. But for that to actually happen now, where so many people in wealthy countries have a mortgage to, you know, eventually try and own their home, it's very difficult to see how people would be willing to take smaller incomes when they're trying to pay off their home.
Right, and sadly, it seems to be going the other way around in North America. There are people working two and three jobs, a lot of part-time jobs, hardly any life after work. And so perhaps in Europe, it's more advanced in the sense of getting a month or two off in the summer, that sort of thing. We've got a long way to go to achieve what you've just talked about. But is it possible that humans can respond in some way to avoid the collapse of the global system, whether we have alternative energy resources, we have emphasis on local food production, we've got all sorts of tools? Can we say that we have what we need to avoid collapse already showing up?
But I think from a physical sense, it's perfectly feasible that we can avoid some collapse, or at least ameliorate things, if indeed it was the early stages of things happening, or in the next decade or so. I think the physical sort of technological side of things is fine. We know what we can do. It's really an issue of, is there the willingness to do that? And that has to happen on many levels, right at the household level, all the way up to, national governments and international bodies. And I suppose it's at that level that I don't see the coordination being there. So part of my message is that it's wise for people to perhaps take things into their own hands a little bit more and not necessarily rely on government. And maybe this is as simple as just learning a new sort of very basic life skills, just growing some vegetables in the backyard, maybe making some bread or cheese, something like that. You know, it's not about wearing hair shirts and stocking cans in the cellar under the cans of tin food in the cellar of the house.
Well, something I've been tossing around in my own mind, it's not really in your paper, but it's something you may have considered as well, and that is a recent guest warned us we should never wait to be vindicated. Even if events turn out the way we predict, the survivors will still rewrite history to suit themselves, and there's not much joy for you and me if we turn out to be right and everything goes downhill badly and quickly. Is there any point to studying where we are and where we might be headed?
Is there any point to studying where we are and where we might be headed? Well, yeah, I think it's, you know, we have to do our best to be as prepared as we can. You know, we have to, although I'm ringing some warning bells here that a collapse may be imminent, you know, it may not come to pass, and I hope not, but just being emotionally aware of these things, I think would be a great help if the worst were to happen. And I think then perhaps people wouldn't feel so caught out or surprised and actually get on with the job of readjusting to what might be a rather simpler or maybe more chaotic world.
Is there anything I've missed that you would like to tell our listeners in parting?
Well, no, I think we've covered a tremendous amount of ground in there. I'd just maybe reiterate, start thinking about working a little less if that's an option, and using that time to connect with people and learning another basic skill.
I'm with you there all the way. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We've been talking with Dr. Graham M. Turner, a Principal Research Fellow at the Melbourne Sustainable Society Institute at the University of Melbourne in Australia. Graham, thank you so much for sharing your research and your time.
It was a pleasure, Alex. Thank you.
I'll put links to that paper in my blog at ecoshock.info. I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio. For the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Coming up, a Canadian forest fire expert on the record boreal and Arctic fires in 2014. One scientist calls them, quote, a major event in the life of the Earth system, end quote. The soot from these fires may be a primary cause of Greenland turning from white to dirty black. That's coming up in 13 minutes. But first, there is another world out there. That's the flow of business, oil, and governments towards an increasing high-carbon future. It's stunning to consider, but the majority view is that the world will produce, consume, and burn ever more oil, gas, and petroleum. Despite concerns about climate change and oil depletion, an American government forecast sees a steady growth in both production and consumption of carbon-based liquid fuels. The latest report, released September 9, 2014, is from the U.S. Energy Information Administration, the EIA. We're joined by Linda Doman, the lead energy analyst for their publication, The International Energy Outlook. Linda, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you very much.
First of all, how do we define liquid fuels?
When we talk about liquid fuels in the context of the International Energy Outlook, we're talking about petroleum and other liquid fuel products, and that be the biofuels, coal to liquids, gas to liquids, natural plant liquids, and crude and lease condensate. So all of the liquid fuels that we would ordinarily use in as a proxy for oil.
It's interesting that you include coal to gas in this forecast. Do you see a growth in conversion of coal to petroleum products?
We really see very little in our outlook. And I should say in our outlook, I'm talking about a reference case projection. So it's kind of a business as usual. Oil prices get up to a real $2012 dollar of $140 per barrel in 2040. So, you know, even at those prices, we still see at the prices that are high enough that supports bringing in kind of the unconventional oil, like the tight oil and the shale oil, but not quite rich enough to support a lot of coal to liquids in our outlook.
Well, from a climate perspective, that's a good thing. Now, is the International Energy Outlook for 2014 a policy statement by the administration, or is it simply a forecast based on what's happening in the development and demand?
Right. It's EIA is policy neutral, so we don't issue policy statements for the administration. So ours, the reference case projection in our cases, is based on current trends and expectations and not anticipating any new legislation that isn't already a law.
Okay, I'm glad we got that clear. How many barrels of liquid fuels did we use in 2010, and where do you see that going by 2020?
I think we were up at about 86, 87 million barrels a day in 2010, and we're up to 119 in 2040. And that is higher than our outlook from last year's 2013 report, and it largely reflects an increase in expectations for economic growth in several parts of the world, but also the relative new abundance of liquids like the tight oil production that's coming out of the United States now, which we see in the long term other parts of the world at least advancing their production of tight oil. So, you know, it makes it a more abundant form of liquid fuels.
So for listeners, that would really mean fracking.
That is the technique for bringing out the tight oils, yeah.
Right. Now, from news stories, I have the impression that American demand for liquid fuels has stabilized or even dropped. What is the truth about that?
Right. Well, we found, generally speaking, and I think maybe demand in the United States was up this year, but generally speaking, we find that the peak use in the developed Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development nations like the United States, like Western Europe and Japan, pretty much peaked in 2005, and we've been generally trending down since then. And we think that the efficiency gains in particular are going to keep liquids from advancing too much further in the OECD countries. But we also see the demand growth potential in improving in places, you know, especially developing Asia, which includes China and India, and the Middle East. We have higher growth this year than we have in the past.
Why is the Middle East increasing their use of liquid fuels?
Well, you know, the first, they've got a very fast-growing population, so that means a lot more driver-age kids and becoming, you know, becoming of age and start driving. And also, many of the key producers of oil in the Middle East, they do subsidize oil for their consumers. So there isn't any trigger that would make consumers stop using oil because it's pretty cheap for them.
Linda, it must be tricky to calculate the amount of fuel a country like China will use 10 or 20 years from now. How do you do it?
It is tricky, and you know, China and India and the Middle East are all areas where we see the greatest uncertainty. And that's kind of why we put out three separate price paths in our International Energy Outlook 2014. And that's sort of understanding that economic growth is really important. And if there's in those areas that we just can see potential high upside and downside, we take for our price scenarios. In the high price case, we're saying that high price is in part driven by the fact that the non-OECD developing countries will grow faster economically than we have in our reference case, and they will drive the prices higher. So you see what happens in those cases. So we We have a fair range of demand within those three areas. In our reference case for the non-OECD countries, which would include China and India and the Middle East, we get up to 75 million barrels a day in 2040 in the reference case. But in our high price case, we actually get up to 80 million barrels a day. So it's substantially higher. And in our low price case, where we assume that growth isn't, that they're, for whatever reasons, they have slower economic growth and slower demand for liquid fuels, they're down to a little under 74 million barrels a day.
But at the upper end of those predictions, China and India and the rest of the world would burn almost as much fuel as the whole world is burning right now.
It does get pretty high. I know that in China, in our reference case, surpasses the consumption in the United States by 2035. So there is substantial growth even in the reference case.
Now, I know some of my listeners will have a hard time believing the world could still find and produce 115 million barrels a day of oil and gas or even coal-based liquids in 2040. Does the EIA analysis attempt to judge whether those demands can be met? And if so, where would it come from?
Well, we do, in fact, pay a lot of attention to where the oil will come from. And we do believe that the non-OPEC producers of the, particularly the tight shale oils, you know, the pre-salts in Brazil and Russia will continue to increase, notwithstanding the geopolitical issues that we have today. So there will be substantial growth of about 10 million barrels a day between 2010 and 2040 that'll come from the non-OPEC petroleum producers. And then we have another 14 million barrels a day that we think will come out of the OPEC producers. And we mainly see the OPEC producers being able to increase production in the Middle East. And it gets a little tricky, especially when you look at everything that's going on today in the Middle East, about figuring out where that might come from. But obviously there's a lot of potential resources that can come online still in Saudi Arabia and Iraq and Iran if we can get beyond the unrest that's there today.
Yes, Iraq has never really produced anything near their potential as far as I know.
That is correct, yeah.
How does the EIA outlook for 2014 compare to previous years, say from 2009 after the economic crash or even 2012? Have there been changes of note you could tell us about?
I think the tight oil production potential really has made a big difference in the last year or so, frankly. And I think we also have seen a lowering of the biofuels potential just because there have been countries that have backed off their goals and targets, and we've kind of accommodated that into our outlook. And we have, I'm not sure since 2009, but for the past couple of years at least, we have been gradually creeping up in terms of how much demand we think is there. You know, the performance over the last at least 10 years of China and India, we've revised our economic growth prospects for them up almost every year, if not every year. So they continue to impress in terms of their growth potential for liquids demand. And I think over the just last year, if you looked at our outlook, we've increased consumption demand for liquids in both Africa and the Middle East. And just that idea that we're revising upward our economic growth prospects from past outlooks.
Linda, what's the most challenging part of trying to prepare these annual estimates for the world energy picture?
There are many challenges associated with trying to get this product out the door. It's particularly challenging because you're doing a long-term forecast. You don't want to presume that just short-term events are going to have, you know, define the path forward 30 years out. But it's really true when you start putting out an outlook, which we started putting this out back in October of last year. And by the time we get to May, there's so many things coming up that you really have to say, well, we want to factor in the potential for growth in Mexico because of the change in Mexican legislation. But what extent can we do it, and is it going to surprise to the upside or the downside, and trying to assess what those might mean for a long-term outlook? I think you asked me a few minutes ago what had changed since the 2009 outlook, and I didn't think of it at the time, but it really was very interesting to go and look at what we were seeing over the past years about Mexico. I think I've been working on the International Energy Outlook since the mid-1990s, and for many years we would believe, you know, eventually Mexico is going to change their legislation. And so until about 2004, we were very hopeful for the long run for Mexico. But at that point, we just made a decision that we really couldn't keep their production profile moving upward, given the lack of legislative change that would allow foreign direct investment in their energy sector. So between 2004 and until the 2014 outlook, we had a very slow declining and then very slow, flat production outlook. And this is the first year, as I say, for 10 years that we've had a substantial increase in our prospects for their long-term production growth.
Now, you mentioned the EIA is independent. Where does it fit in the American administrative structure, just so we know?
We are part of the Department of Energy, and we are the statistical and analytical branch of the Department of Energy. So we are part of the executive branch, but we are very proud of our independence in terms of not speaking for either the Congress or the executive administration, but giving policy neutral, analytical reports on what may or may not happen in the future.
Also, I was wondering, are any of these estimates prepared by private contractors or outside companies on behalf of the U.S. government?
I'm not sure what you're asking me.
Well, you've been working on this since the 1990s. Is the whole thing done in-house by U.S. government, or are there private contractors involved as well?
The report itself is prepared in-house. We do have a professional editor that works on our language for us to make sure that we flow well and have one voice, because there are a number of people that work on the report, the writing of it. We do hire consultancies for specific information. You may know EIA partnered or hired ARI, which is a private consultancy, to help work on our assessment of world shale resources. So in that sense, you know, we do go out and purchase information and expertise on specific facets that we need to understand better.
Well, we're going to have to wrap it up there. Is there anything else that you would like to leave with our listeners?
I hope they all go out and download a copy of our International Energy Outlook 2014, and that if they are interested in long-term international projections, that they will return to the Energy Information Administration's website in mid-2015 to download our full report, which will include supply and demand for all fuels and our 16 regions out to 2040.
Okay, well, just to simplify things, I'll put links to your report in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. People can find the link there. We've been hearing about the World Liquid Fuel Outlook from Linda Domann, the lead analyst for the International Energy Outlook, published annually by the U.S. government. Thank you so much, Linda.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Radio EcoShock.
Slate Magazine is running a stunning story, Why Greenland's Dark Snow Should Worry You. Don't miss those photos from Danish scientist Jason Box. They show what should be white ice and snow of Greenland have turned dirty black. That means the surface absorbs far more heat from the sun instead of reflecting light back into space. Expect record ice melt and another jump toward rising seas. But where does that dirt come from? Certainly from coal power plants in America and China, from polluting industries in Europe and Russia, but I suspect the largest amount comes from soot. Siberia has plenty of fires, but northern Canada just experienced the greatest fire season ever recorded. I've reached a fire expert to talk about it. Regular EcoShock listeners know wildfires in the Arctic are bigger and badder than ever. Scientists predict a huge increase over the coming decades due to changes in climate and various feedbacks triggered by global warming. Could the whole boreal forest burn down? New research has taken us deeper into fire behavior in the far north. The paper that caught my eye is titled Resistance of the Boreal Forest to High Burn Rates. Our next guest is one of the authors, Marc-André Parisien, is a research scientist for the Northern Forest Center of the Canadian Fire Service, located in Edmonton, Alberta. Mark, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
Well, Mark, most of us can barely imagine the size and the way this great boreal forest is. How big is it, and what would it be like to be there?
Well, it's a pretty big place. It's about 1.7 square kilometers, so that's just over half of the landmass of Canada. And, of course, I'm very biased, but I think it's a wonderful place. It's very humbling to know that I'm hundreds of kilometers away from any kind of human settlement or roads, and I find it both scary and appeasing. It's a forest that's very green, where there's lots of water, and because it's so far north, there's all this great light all summer. But it's also a fire ecologist's paradise, because it's a forest that's been shaped by large and intense wildfires. And when I was there in the last 3 years, we were working and living in the smoke for most of our time up in the Northwest Territories. Perhaps unpleasant for some people, but I thought it was great.
Did you mean 1.7 million square kilometers, or what was the size? I'm sorry, I missed that.
Yeah, it's 1.7 million square kilometers.
Okay. Now, as you know, television doesn't really report on fires in Canada's far north the way they do city fires, and most of these blazes run their course, as far as I can tell, with no one trying to put them out. How big can a fire get?
Well, they get huge, hundreds of thousands of hectares. So if you think of Manhattan, that's 9,000 hectares. There was a forest fire in Quebec a couple of years ago that was recorded as 560,000 hectares. There's been several in the Northwest Territories and, of course, in Siberia this summer that were hundreds of thousands of hectares. They are very, very large, and altogether, they can burn millions of hectares in Canada. This summer, I guess we're at about 4.6 million hectares just in Canada.
So a single fire might be bigger than a European country, for example.
Well, 4.6 million hectares is quite a bit larger than Switzerland, so pretty fair chunk of land.
So looking at the future, what is the range of predicted increase in the area burned each year as we reach the end of the 21st century?
Well, it does vary a lot among regions and among studies, but the range we found in the literature was 30 to 500%.
That's stunning. 500%, that wouldn't leave much of the forest left, would it?
It would not.
Well, now, how do we know global warming is a big factor behind this increase in boreal forest fires?
Well, we know because the link between weather and its long-term average climate is pretty well understood. And because the highest recorded increases in temperatures have been observed at high latitudes, we've been able to track some of these changes and establish pretty solid correlation over the last 50-100 years. This said, climate's not the only factor. The boreal forest is an increasingly busy place, and humans are certainly affecting some of the fire regimes there.
And one of the key discoveries made, and this study was led by scientists from the University of Quebec, was to find a kind of braking system that could limit fires in the far north. We just talked about 500%, there wouldn't be much left, but maybe there's something that could stop that from happening. But before we reach that conclusion, can you tell us why and how you did this study?
Sure. So in the boreal forest of North America, it's been assumed that fires burn independently of the age of the forest stand, which is really the time since the last fire. In other words, forests that burned just a few years ago are just as likely to burn than those forests that burned 100 years ago. Now, it's been our intuition that this is not the case. Recent burns do indeed limit where and how future fires burn. This may be irrelevant where there's not a whole lot of fires on the landscape, but it may be very important in those parts of the boreal forest that have been just plastered with fires over the last few decades. So we set out to sample one of those areas by reconstructing past fires. And specifically, what we looked at is overlapping fires over the last 200 years, over a 190-kilometer transect in northern Quebec. This allowed us to determine if fires tend to reburn or overlap randomly, or if recent fires don't burn quite as often as would be predicted by chance alone.
So from your research, what is, if any, the limit to the amount of forest that burns?
Well, it's safe to say that the influence of weather on fire is pretty well understood. We know that fires burn when it's hot, when it's dry, when it's windy. What's less well understood is the likelihood of what it is on the ground, the vegetation, to burn. And this study, I believe, provides a piece of that puzzle. Basically, in our study area, forests that burned 40 to 50 years ago are less likely to reburn than older forests. So when you've burned, you've got a few decades there where you may still burn. This study is not saying that it is impossible that young forests reburn, but they do at a much lesser rate than old forests.
Okay. Now, moving to a different topic, when I interviewed Dr. Michael Flanagan a couple of years ago, he told us fires can burn so hot and so deep, perhaps into the peat in the ground, that the soil is sterilized, leaving nothing to grow back. Have you seen or heard of this phenomenon, and is it a concern?
Well, in various parts of Canada, I've heard of areas being deforested. In fact, I've seen many of them. And that's not only in peatlands, but also in upland forests. If these situations become more common, there's no doubt to me that people will start getting concerned, whether it's from a standpoint of socioeconomics, carbon dynamics, or protecting the ecological integrity. And some of these areas truly look like moonscapes. You've had a fire, say, 20 years ago, and another fire not too long after that, and the trees just don't have time to rebound, and there's no seeds on site to regenerate.
And I understand some fires can even create their own weather systems, complete with winds or even thunder. Can you tell us about that?
Well, absolutely. It's just mind-boggling how much energy is transferred in some of these large fires. Fires can create a really impressive convection column that just rolls onto the landscape and indeed creates its own weather with sometimes rain, sometimes lightning, and sometimes even fire whirls, which are little fire tornadoes.
You wouldn't want to see one of those close up.
No.
All right. Now, for me, the key here is whether this balancing of forest and wildfires that you talk about in your paper could save the boreal forests as a functioning ecosystem, even with the abnormally hot temperatures we expect to develop in the north over time. Have you given that some thought?
Yeah, and there's no easy answer here. I think it's hard to tell because fire is not the only factor. You can have some major changes in hydrology, in tree growth, in the distribution of forest pests, like mountain pine beetle. If you think of a major thaw of permafrost, for example, that'll have huge impacts on your ecosystems up there. And fire will invariably interact with these altered systems, and they'll create new, novel forest dynamics. But what are the outcomes? They're highly uncertain.
So we're rolling the dice. We don't know what's going to happen.
We know part of the story, but incrementally, we're trying to figure it out.
Would your research apply just as well to forests and fires in Siberia?
You know, I'm not sure. The Siberian boreal forest is a different beast altogether. It's quite different from the North American boreal forest. So I think we can be cautious and say, to what extent does this negative feedback apply to the Siberian boreal forest? We don't really know just yet.
And I want to pick up on something that showed up in a couple of blogs. It appears from satellite photos taken in early August that there was a wildfire right near the Laptev Sea in Siberia. That's so far north, there are no trees. How would a fire be possible there?
Well, it is possible. And we're also seeing more and more of these fires in the tundra in North America. Basically, if all the ingredients are there, an ignition source, biomass to burn, and fire-conducive weather, any type of vegetation can experience pretty large wildfires. And perhaps you don't have a lot of trees burning up there, but you can have a lot of peat burning, you can have a lot of shrubs burning, you can have a lot of grasses burning, but they do seem to be becoming more and more common.
This is Radio EcoShock with my guest Marc-André Parisien, a research scientist with the Canadian Fire Service. Mark, in our winter of 1997-98, gigantic peat fires in Indonesia propelled that country to become the world's third largest source of greenhouse gas emissions. It was a huge burst of carbon, and then burning peat was also found in the deadly Russian heat wave of 2010. Could we see another big burst of carbon if Arctic peat catches fire on a big scale?
Possibly, but I think there's a lot more peat burning in the boreal forest than in the Arctic per se. And during those big fire years in the boreal forest, so years like this year, the boreal forest is a fairly important carbon source rather than a carbon sink. So it emits more carbon than it actually assimilates.
And are you aware of any scientist or paper that has attempted to calculate the amount of carbon going into the atmosphere from wildfires in Canada's north?
Yeah, there are several researchers working on this. One of them is a colleague of mine, Brian Amiro. At the Canadian Forest Service, we try to calculate emissions from fires. So I've got some colleagues, Ron Hall, Werner Kurtz, that are working on this. And there's also several American colleagues that are working on this question, folks like Merit Turetsky and Eric Kosciuszko. So it's a very important field of study, and I think we're getting closer to understanding it every year.
Does Canada offer statistics and satellite photos online for the public so we can tune into this?
Absolutely. So we've got a fairly nice site at the Canadian Forest Service, if I'm allowed a little bit of blatant self-promotion. It's called the Canadian Wildland Information System, and I'd be happy to give you the web link if you'd like.
I would like that. If you could send it to me, I'll put it in my blog at ecoshock.info so people can tune into it. It's probably got quite a long URL, does it?
It does have a fairly long URL.
Okay.
I'd better just send it to you.
Send it to me in email. I'll stick it on the blog at ecoshock.info. So listeners, you can pick it up there every Wednesday that blog gets published. So I've been reading about the feedback loops from forest fires in high latitudes. For example, soot can blacken the snow and ice. That leads to earlier melt, longer fire seasons, more fires. Are there other feedback loops, and are scientists trying to study these complex effects of the fires?
Well, nature often has lots of checks and balances and that create positive and negative feedbacks. And there are some groups working on that. They're fairly complex models because nature is fairly complicated. But I would say that generally the jury is still out whether fires in some cases can create net warming or net cooling, because there's certainly all kinds of feedbacks that can affect your fire carbon dynamics here.
Right. I mean, smoke from fires actually reduces the amount of sunlight reaching the surface of the ground for a little while anyway. So that's a bit of a cooling effect there.
Yeah. Now, is it a negligible or a measurable effect? I'm not sure. I'm not a carbon guy per se, but I have a kind of a general knowledge of what's going on.
Okay. Now, are there differences between a wildfire in the boreal, such as you study, or even further north, compared to the big wildfires we've seen this year in California or Washington State?
Well, keeping in mind that wildfires are extremely variable, I would say that, yes, there are fairly important differences. One fundamental difference is that boreal fires tend to kill most of the trees, whereas fires in the dry forest of the western U.S. Do not. There's more of a mixed severity there. It kills some trees, but many of the bigger trees do survive the fire.
That's an important difference. So, Marc-André Parisien, if we determine the boreal forest ecosystem is in danger from increasing wildfires as the world continues to heat, is there anything we could do to intervene or to prevent or fight these fires?
Well, given the size of the boreal forest, our mitigation actions would only be limited and fairly localized. However, some of the bigger threats to ecological integrity may not come from the forest fires, but change in the physical environment, such as permafrost melting or forest pests, or simply the climatic stress on plants. And I think that's an active area of research.
And looking at the whole fire system in the north, in your opinion, what kind of research still needs to be done as a priority?
Well, that's a little bit in the eye of the beholder, Alex, but I think we need to pursue our work on how to better understand where, when, and how fires tend to burn. Once we have a greater knowledge of these dynamics, we can predict the changes to come and derive some sensible adaptation strategies. Also, I'd say that given how important fire is to the boreal forest dynamics, we need to know more about the human impacts on fire regimes. My feeling is that as development accelerates in the boreal forest, in some areas the anthropogenic impacts will dwarf the impacts caused by climate. So it remains to be seen.
Well, you know, of the things we've been talking about, one of the things that really interests me personally is the relationship of the forests and the permafrost. I've been to a lecture on permafrost melting. It's a long, slow process, but, you know, you get these things like drunk forests where the trees fall over because their whole root systems have been disturbed by the melting of the permafrost.
Yeah, and I think we can expect to see much, much more of that in the upcoming years. And it'll be very interesting to see how fires tend to burn in those areas. Some of them have meters of peat accumulation, and it's one thing to observe, study, fight a fire that you can see, but a fire that's burning underground, just smoldering deep in the peat with pretty much no smoke, well, that's another ballgame altogether.
What are you going to be working on next, Mark?
I'm going to be working on predicting fire refugia. So I want to know these parts of the boreal forest that almost never burn or that burn not as intensely. I think that these areas can act as holdovers or stepping stones for a lot of the species of plants and animals as the landscapes, the regions around them change very rapidly.
That sounds really worthwhile to me. Our guest has been Canadian forest research scientist Marc-André Parisien. He is an author on the new paper, Resistance of the Boreal Forest to High Burn Rates, and that's published in PNAS, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and the official data publication is August 4th, 2014. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks a lot, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. Tired of cheerleaders and phony media issues?
We treat climate change almost as if it's something external. It's a sort of problem that we've created that we can solve with human genius. But I don't think it is. I think climate change is our society. Climate change is who we are.
Looking for the awful truth? Dig in with Alex Smith.
Actually, you're never going to get millions of people on the streets to campaign against climate change because they'll be campaigning against their own way of life. And so we're all complicit in that system. The voters are complicit, the corporations are complicit, the politicians are complicit, and we might want to stop climate change, but actually I don't think that we can, at least within the timescale that's apparently available to us. And I think we need to be honest about that, because only when we're honest about that can we start to think about what we do next.
Top scientists, authors, and activists, the ones you want to hear. No fear, Deep Green Radio EcoShock. Join us. Next week, we'll find out why the U.S. government and governments around the world, including yours, are lying to themselves and us about the true threat of methane gas. A group of top climate scientists have written a powerful letter to change that. Join us next week on Radio EcoShock. Get links to stories in our programs this week from our show blog at ecoshock.info. You can find all our past programs as free MP3 downloads at our website, ecoshock.org. Don't forget about our SoundCloud page. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening, and thank you for caring about our world.